From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we follow up with the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Robert Wilkie, on his recent trip to Milwaukee. Then our gardening contributor talks about planting and pest management after Milwaukee's very damp spring.
Tomatoes and peppers and some of your annuals, you put them in the ground, and a month later, they're not as big as you would expect. And so that's been very stressful for gardeners and the plants.
Bubbler Talk visits the motels on South 27th Street. And a new PBS documentary looks at how love, religion, and civil rights are expressed between evangelical Christians and the LGBTQ population in Eureka Springs, Arkansas.
To find a place like Eureka where people feel free to leave their faith, keep their faith, redefine their faith, whatever their political position is, was kind of a miracle to me.
Lake Effect Weekend is next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. Back in April, we spoke with the U.S. Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Robert Wilkie, about the evolution of care within the VA system. It's an issue that's important to our state. 2017 figures show that Wisconsin is home to almost 400,000 veterans. It's also important to the greater Milwaukee area as well. In 2018, the Zablocki VA Medical Center here had more than 850,000 inpatient, outpatient, and emergency room visits. And more than 400 veterans were treated at its state-of-the-art Spinal Cord Injury Center as well. On July 1st, Secretary Wilkie made a visit to the Zablocki VA, and we were able to speak with him in person to follow up on our earlier conversation. Wilkie began by reiterating how important the state has been and continues to be within Veterans Affairs.
Wisconsin has been on the cutting edge of how we need to refocus and rethink the way we approach some of America's greater health crises. Particularly addiction, and it flows from that suicide. I'm headed up to Toma tomorrow. Toma was the epicenter for VA in terms of what we needed to do to change the trajectory in terms of treating veterans for pain. We have a unique population, people like my father, 30 years of jumping out of airplanes, war wounds from Vietnam, from several tours, and looking at a lifetime of chronic pain. Toma and Milwaukee broke the mold on the way we think about that. Traditionally, pain medicine and people go off on their own into the shadows. We were in the middle of a crisis. And because of the work they've done here, VA has led the way in terms of reducing opioid prescriptions. We're down by about 51%. We're promoting alternative therapy, Tai Chi, yoga, aqua therapy, acupuncture, things that would have been unthinkable to my father's generation. And we're now substituting opioids with over-the-counter medicine combinations like acetaminophen and aspirin, ibuprofen and aspirin, to get at the source of the pain and stop messing with this brain that the opioid does.
When you and I spoke back in April, the Mission Act had not yet quite gotten put into place. It's been in place now about
almost a month.
What are the early statistics telling you?
Well, the first day we had 44,000 calls. We haven't had that many on any day since then. But what are we seeing? We are seeing veterans not so much choosing regular medical care in the private sector for complicated things. What we're seeing them choosing is urgent care, something that their neighbors have, something that they understand. We think it's important because it keeps them out of emergency rooms. One of the things I said, I think, when we talked in April, I described what it isn't. It's not libertarian VA. I'm not giving you a card that says veteran and you go out and prosper. What this does is it gives you the option, if we can't provide you with what you need, to go through with us a list of our community care providers, pick one, fits your needs, and then we can send you there. we are at the lowest percentage of veterans since the end of World War II who are asking to go in the private sector. So they're voting with their feet. They want to come someplace where people understand the culture and speak the language. So I don't expect a great spike or even a minimal spike when it comes to those asking for alternative treatment. What I do expect is the number of veterans asking for urgent care, participating in urgent care, to go up.
So I assume that setting up urgent care clinics, like a lot of the hospitals around here have, Columbia St. Mary's has it, I think Frederick have them too, where you can go and it keeps you out of the emergency room, but you don't have to get an appointment with your doctor.
Right.
It was more cost effective to do the Mission Act rather than set up VA type clinics.
Now, I think some of the facilities have them, but it's much more cost effective for a cold or the flu or a sprained ankle. To have someone go to urgent care and free up an emergency room for those who are in acute need.
I know some of the things that people were concerned about when this big transition was happening was that computer systems and other infrastructure wasn't going to be able to keep up with that sudden switch on. What's happening there?
Well, it has gone off, thank goodness, without a hitch. We were able to approach this, and my background is military. I came over as the Undersecretary of Defense. We set up a traditional military joint operations center that all of our hospital directors and network directors participated in. It was up 24 hours a day. They had training, not only training from us, but they trained the people. We haven't had any hitches across the country. Now, in an organization that has 390,000 employees plus 9.5 million patients, will there be something out there? Probably. But for an operation with this scope and size, this has moved. It's such a good pace that the critics have been quiet. I testified a few days ago in front of the Senate committee. I had to bring up Mission because nobody felt the need to talk about it. They wanted to talk about suicide. But no one talked about Mission because they now accept that as something that is in place and working.
Let's talk about suicide. It's a very difficult thing to talk about. I know when we spoke in April, it's one of the key things that you're trying to mitigate, you're trying to work on from the top down. Also, people from the bottom up are also trying to work. I know there's a lot of folks here who are working different pieces of that. What are some of the things that we need to be thinking about to help people who need this kind of help?
Well, I think as a nation, and this is much broader than VA, as a nation, we need to have a national conversation about how we approach life, in the sense that we have never had a conversation in this country about mental health. I've said to the New York Times, I've said to NPR, that we're not even at the Sputnik stage when it comes to getting our arms around mental health. That is really, to me, the crux of this. For VA, that means we provide same-day mental health services. We are starting to begin now with educating troops when they're in basic training and in their military career in a way that would have been unthinkable in my father's day in the Vietnam era. But we have to start talking about it. So for us, that means expanding things like telehealth, so we get out into the most remote parts of the country. That means spending money. The budget that I presented has $9.5 billion for mental health services. But it also means playing to VA's strength, and that is a community of people in uniform, people who wore the uniform, and playing off of that communication, that sense of family that they have. I think when I finish, and I'm the head of the President's Task Force on Suicide Prevention, I think at the end of the day, hopefully kicking off that mental health discussion, but I will be able to give to Zablocki or give to some of our other hospitals the ability to work more closely with the non-governmental organization, the states and localities, get money into those areas to help them help find those veterans that we're just not capable of getting to. But mental health is the key, and then there is a continuum that you talked about before, addiction and homelessness. They're all part of the same trajectory.
And we're also dealing, I think, with a culture that, and you mentioned it earlier, we don't talk about it.
Right.
And the military, certainly.
Right.
Anyone who served in the military knows you don't talk about that because it's a weakness.
Right.
And you're not supposed to have that kind of weakness. There's something wrong with
that's
you.
That's right. I think there's less of that now. Let's go back to Major Wilkie, my father. When he was last in Vietnam in 1970, he was a major. If he had evidenced distress, if he had talked about it, that was the draftee military. There were 10,000 guys waiting to fill those shoes. Practically, you can't do that anymore. We have an all-volunteer military, and we have a different society. And we have to concentrate on taking care of the people who volunteer. So that means the minute they walk into basic training, they are told at that stage and then continuing that if you see something in your buddy, say something. If you feel bad, if you feel anxiety, if you feel depressed, you need to tell somebody. Now, have we turned the corner in accepting that completely? No. There are some parts of the military where, no, that would not be accepted even today. But when you make a cultural change, it's difficult and it takes time. But it has to start there. It has to start there because that's the generation that will be filling VA from here on out.
When I was serving, it was in the early 80s, and it was still not something you talked
Absolutely.
About. And that's
Absolutely.
35 years ago.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I certainly saw it growing up around, I'll just say it, the most macho of all units, the 82nd Airborne Division. My father was a senior officer in the All-American Division. The thought that they would talk about things like that was anathema to the culture. But it's a different time. And I think VA can help America focus on this problem that impacts every walk of life in this country.
I'm thinking about a lot of the work that I know people do here. There's
right.
Guitars for Vets.
Yeah.
There's Shakespeare with Veterans.
Absolutely.
These are both civilian and VA mm-hmm. combined
right.
resources that help veterans
right.
and help, I think, even more importantly, while it's important to help the veterans, it's important to help the civilian population understand
right.
what the veterans are going through as best
yeah.
as they can. Do you see as part of that mental health budget being able to support those kinds of
oh,
partnerships?
Sure. Yeah, that's part of it. And that there are two parts of it. There's the strict medical budget, and then that is broken down into different categories. But yes, that's part of our whole mental health outreach. And it is a sea change. I use the example. I was in Hawaii in December, and I heard – no, don't laugh. I heard hula music. But I looked in and there were 12 Vietnam-era soldiers moving knees and arms and shoulders to that as a means of combating pain instead of using opioids. To me, culture is the key, and the military culture is unique. And where I think, even though less than 1% of the population serves or has served, I think where we can help is that at a basic level, most Americans know that soldiering is different. It's different from any other walk of life. And if we can provide some sort of way forward, I think that'll, on mental health, on addiction, I think that'll be one of the best services that we could provide.
So, Mr. Secretary, looking forward now, Mission Act is in place, things that hopefully the budget will pass
yes.
and you'll get the money that you asked
right.
for. What are some of the big challenges you're tackling next?
Well, the next part of the Mission Act, and it's one that's very important here in Wisconsin because at this stage in 2019, the majority of veterans who use VA here in the state are still of the Vietnam era. We are tasked with providing support and resources to the families who take care of Vietnam veterans at home, family caregivers. We're the only medical institution that puts as much emphasis on taking care of a patient at home as opposed to being in the hospital. We have to get that system right. I've said I'm not going to take anyone off of it, and I'm certainly not going to certify that program until I'm convinced that all of the IT programs are in place and working. I think this is a wonderful step forward. And coming from my world, it's really one of the last loops to close from the Vietnam era, that we finally we do something to help those families who went through those times in the 60s and 70s.
Well, sir, I want to thank you so much for talking with us again. It is a pleasure to meet you in
person.
Well,
I thank you for everything you do to make veteran stories accessible to the public. Thank you.
Robert Wilkie is the U.S. Secretary of Veterans Affairs. We spoke with him at the Zablocki VA Medical Center last week. You can hear our April conversation with him and find out more about the services that the VA provides from links at WUWM.com. If you're a gardener worried about the state of your vegetables after the damp spring, well, you're not alone. Lake Effect contributor Melinda Myers joins us next to talk about pest and disease management. That's when Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Summer is finally here, and it looks like it's here to stay. But after the cool, damp spring we had, many gardeners are still working to get plants into the ground and trying to undo some of the damage caused by the weather. Well, Melinda Myers is here to help. Myers is the author of numerous gardening books, including Month by Month Gardening in Wisconsin and The Midwest Gardener's Handbook. She joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers in the studio to talk about summer planting and pest management.
Because of the cool weather and a lot of rain, things just sat there. Tomatoes and peppers and some of your annuals, you put them in the ground, and a month later, they're not as big as you would expect. And so that's been very stressful for gardeners and the plants. These last few warm days are really, you're seeing things kick into growing and starting to maybe catch up a bit to what we would expect. So if you were lucky enough to get plants in between all the rain showers, they're really starting to take off. The good news is you can still do a lot of planting, and there are a lot of garden centers that have good quality plants available. And if you're like me, you still have a few things in flats that need to get in the garden because you had a day off when it rained. And so there's still time to plant. I think gardeners are great optimists, so don't give up. But you're right, this crazy weather, we saw a lot of rain. So if you haven't been doing things to manage rain, to keep it where it falls, you may want to keep that in mind. Rain barrels, you know, a rain garden, if that's an issue. Improving your soil, you know, adding organic matter, especially those with clay soil, it helps absorb that water so you don't get the puddling. Fresh Coast Guardians has lots of great tips on that on their website. So take, you know, every year is a lesson in my book is how are we going to manage it? I did get plants in between the rainfall and covered things with row covers. They let air, light, and water through but trap the heat. So a lot of my things are catching up because I kept them warm during those cooler days, protected my cabbages from cabbage worms. And so I got kind of double the benefit trying to fight the weather and the insects.
If you're someone like me who did not put covers on theirs, you might be dealing with some issues. You know, I've had some plants that are showing a lot of yellowing and other plants that have some spotting.
Yeah, so yellowing could be from too much water. That's, you know, especially if you're in heavy clay soil. There's not much you can do to stop rainfall, but also making sure when you do think we need to water, especially when we have this hot weather and plants look wilted in the middle of the day, give them time. Let the sun go down, the temperatures to cool, and often they'll perk up. And that's a sign that it's the hot weather. They're wilting to protect and conserve moisture. So morning is not only the best time to water, but it's also a good way to read if your plants need it. Now, containers need watering every day. Also, if you're gardening and we've had lots of rainfall, it washes a lot of the nutrients through, especially in containers that are watered daily if you have fast-draining soil. So you may need to give your plants a little bit of a nutrient boost. I like using low-nitrogen, slow-release fertilizer. People who know me know it's Milorganite, but any low-nitrogen, slow-release, you know, fertilizer, because with this hot weather, you don't want to damage your plants. They've gone from cool and wet to really hot temperatures. So that low nitrogen, slow release, like Milorganite, will help slowly feed the plants, but it won't harm them as we get those hot temperatures that we're experiencing now.
If you're dealing with something like spotting, or you're noticing any kind of, you know, something funky that looks like a disease, what should you be doing?
Good question. So the first thing to do is, you know, remove those spotted leaves, because many times it's just a matter of sanitation, removing the few infected leaves because they may have the spores to infect the rest of the plant. Make a note, okay, this week I had 3 spotted leaves. They look like this. It started now. If it continues, the internet's a wonderful resource. I always go to educational sites like the University of Wisconsin because then you know it's something science-based. And often you can go, okay, spots on my tomatoes, and they'll give you images of 3 or 4 possible diseases and options for controlling it. I try to use natural or environmentally friendly products whenever possible. You know, I'm growing my own food and plants, so I can control the inputs, and that's why I think a lot of people garden. So a lot of things like removing spotted leaves, adjusting watering. If you've been watering, we can't stop the rainfall. Sometimes mulching the soil traps soil-borne diseases in the soil so it doesn't splash up. Removing those lower leaves so that when diseases do splash up, they don't hit the leaves. There are some organic products you can use. Neem, N as in Nancy, E-E-M as in Mary, is an organic. One form controls insects, the other form manages diseases. Horticulture oils, like Summit year-round spray oil, is wonderful because it will suffocate like powdery mildew. If you have a white powdery substance on your leaves, peonies have been hit bad the last few years, that will help give you some control. Or powdery mildew on your zucchinis, and it's organic. Insecticidal soap is excellent if you've got insects. I just had a friend bring me a picture. He goes, what are those black things on the tip of my Amber Jubilee nine bark? And I went, oh, they're aphids. Now, he's just going to prune off those few spaces where the aphids are attacking, dispose of them in a plastic bag and throw them out. But if it continues, the insecticidal soap will also help control those without harming the ladybugs, because we want them to move in and eat the aphids. So the less we do and the more we work in tune with nature, the better for our plants and the environment and our water quality, because all of these chemicals get washed into our storm sewers. And so we want to be very careful and gentle for our own health and benefit and the health of our landscape.
Well, and that's another question I had. You know, I noticed on some of our plants right after the rainfall, I started looking at the stalks and I went, oh, I'm seeing some little white guys with some little antlers on their head. A number of little slugs had popped out onto, you know, our herb garden. But we're also seeing, you know, some spots on leaves, some little holes in the leaves as it's gotten warmer.
So slugs, the great year for slugs, they like cool, dark, damp conditions, often found on hostas, but they'll also eat holes in your tomato. They hide at night or hide in the day, and at night they come out when we're asleep and they start munching holes. Shallow can with beer actually works well. Sink it in the ground. Take half a bottle, empty it any way you want, lay it on the side, and they actually do crawl in the hole. And the benefit of that is that bottle provides a shield so that when it rains, you don't dilute the beer and have to change it as often. There are environmentally friendly products like Sluggo or Escargo. They contain iron phosphate as the active ingredient. Most slug baits are very toxic. These are considered organic. They poison the slug, but it won't hurt the toads and the birds that eat the slug, even if they're poisoned. So it's an option if the beer doesn't seem like one. I hide my little cans of beer under the leaves of the hosta so it looks a little neat and tidy.
Is there any concern, and this was something you know, I've noticed more in our house, you know, flies and that kind of thing. But is there any concern about, you know, all of the insects that are kind of popping up eating your garden?
You know, some of them are harmful because they'll damage the fruit. So if you get out and harvest regularly so you don't have overripe fruit, that's where picnic beetles move in. They don't hurt you, but they annoy and they speed ripening. And so it's a nightmare. And if you treat it for them, then you delay harvest and then you get more overripe fruit. So, you know, trapping them with yeast and molasses at the edge of the garden or trying to keep up on harvesting is one option to do. Also, if you have kids or people with lots of energy, I call it the pluck, stomp, and drop method. I learned from kids in Hamilton, Ontario. They learn the good and the bad, and they pluck the bad guys off, drop them on the ground, and stomp them. And if you have kids or grandkids that help you in the garden, that's a great way to expend some energy. And it teaches them the good guys, because they're good guys like lacewings and praying mantids and walking sticks and ladybugs we mentioned before that eat the bad guy. So if we work with nature, they usually take care of a lot of the problems for us.
So speaking of, you know, getting the good guys into your garden. If you're someone who's looking around your garden and saying, you know, maybe I need a few more pollinators over here, what can you do?
That's a great point. We often put our flowers in one area and our vegetables in the other. And, you know, adding flowers to the garden, I'm big into ornamental, flavorful gardens. I lived in the city so long that I wanted it all. So I mixed everything together. And that helped bring in a lot of the pollinators. Herbs are great for attracting bees we need for pollination. Some of the beetles that eat the bad guys. So mixing flowers into your garden is a great way to add some beauty. A little aromatherapy. I liked sweet alyssum with my parsley as an edge. So I had that aroma from the sweet alyssum. The parsley I could eat. The swallowtail caterpillars like to eat the parsley too. And so putting flowers in and amongst your vegetables or at the edge of the garden or the end of the bed is a great way to bring those pollinators to help with production, but also to bring in the good guys that take care of some of the bad ones.
Yeah. So as a kind of final note here, if you're someone who is still looking to plant, maybe was a little turned off by the rain, but really wants to get out there now, is there anything that's going to go in July?
Oh, you bet. There's still a lot of things you can plant. So even from seed, one of the things I like is broccoli, cabbage, those cool crops that taste better when it's cool. So if you can find some transplants now, get them in your garden. They'll be ready in fall. The temperatures are cool. They'll take a light frost and taste great. Beans, cucumbers, they have enough time if you plant them now, even through July, till our first fall frost to grow, mature, and produce enough for you to harvest. Short season crops like radishes and lettuce and other greens, plenty of time. So look at the tag or the seed packet, see how many days from planting to harvest, and then calculate, take a guess, when our first fall frost will come. And, you know, usually I figure about mid-October. Sometimes I've been disappointed. Sometimes I get an extra month and we don't have that frost till November. And you can always cover things for those first few fall frosts. But that's a way to don't give up on the season. Take care of those weeds, unfortunately, that are thriving. Get some veggies in and you'll have plenty to eat this fall.
Great. Well, Melinda, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Well, thanks so much. And here's to keep growing throughout the rest of the season.
Melinda Myers is the author of numerous books on gardening, including Month by Month Gardening in Wisconsin and the Midwest Gardener's Handbook. She is also our regular gardening contributor, and she spoke with Joy Powers. Coming up next, Bubbler Talk visits South 27th Street to find out more about all those mom-and-pop motels there. Lake Effect Weekend continues with Bubbler Talk in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
If you've ever driven down South 27th Street in Franklin, you probably already know this, but there are a lot of motels there. El Rancho, the Knotty Pine, Sunrise, Modern 41, Embassy, the Oakwood, and the list goes on and on. My count, 10 within a 2-mile drive, which takes about 3 minutes. Over the years, lots of people have written in to Bubbler Talk asking about those motels. The most recent question came from a guy named Don Glue.
Hi, Bubbler Talk. I was just wondering, why are there so many mom-and-pop motels on the stretch of South 27th Street in Franklin, between Ryan and Drexel? Why are they there, and how do they survive?
It's a stretch of road that Glue says he drives quite often from his home in Wind Point to Lowell's. Now, to answer the first part of Glue's question, why are there so many motels? We have to transport back in time. Back to the days before the interstate system.
This used to be old Highway 41.
That's Vaso Dragitovich. For the past 30-plus years, he's owned Traveler's Motel on South 27th Street. The telltale motel sign out front of his place reads, Traveler's Motel, all the comforts of home. It also advertises cable TV and high-speed internet.
If you look at it, 41 coming out of Oshkosh, coming down through Milwaukee, Appleton, through the coming down through West Bend, Menominee Falls, Fond du Lac, coming this way, shooting through Milwaukee, going through Kenosha, you know, Waukegan. This is all smaller motels that you see along the 41, Highway 41.
In other words, Highway 41 used to be the main thoroughfare between Chicago and Milwaukee and beyond. People needed places to stay while on the road, so you saw the development of motels, lots of them. But these days, with the popularity of well-known hotel chains and the advent of websites that allow for home sharing, who's keeping these motels in business? Vaso says between March and Thanksgiving, 15 of his 24 rooms are reserved every week, Monday through Friday, by people working on road construction jobs or at the Oak Creek Power Plant. The nightly rate at Traveler's Motel is about $40. He doesn't do hourly rentals. Vaso says some of his customers have been coming there for as long as he's owned the place.
So these are the people that come around and look for these hotels, motels. They are reasonable for them. They work, you know, Monday through Friday, just like we all do. They are 3-4 hours away from here, and they find this little bit reasonable for them to pour, you know, to put bread and butter on the table when they come home to kids and wives on the weekends. This is their home.
Vaso says he understands that motels often get a bad rap. Some people associate them with drugs and prostitution, but Vaso says don't believe the rumors, or at least realize that not all motels are bad.
Well, you know, what people talk, you know, you can't close people's mouth. People always can talk, but you want to listen to the people. You want to see the facts. You want to see the people that use the places, the people that come and visit the places, and then they can tell you the truth.
Vaso says that while he and his wife have put money into their motel, including a complete reconstruction, some people have not, and he says it shows. He says he and his wife live on the premises, raised their two children there, and it's now a place where their grandchildren spend a lot of time. Four bikes are stored against the wall near the patio table and chairs, overlooking the vegetable and flower gardens. Out front, there's a basketball hoop and a trampoline. A quick call to the alderman for the district says that while police do keep an eye out on the motels, none of them are bringing trouble to the area. So the next time you find yourself avoiding a motel based upon a preconceived notion, Vaso says don't. He says ring the doorbell and ask to have a look at a room and then decide.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Pottawatomie Hotel and Casino, home to 24/7 entertainment, dining, and musical acts, plus additional hotel rooms and Ember Salon and Spa, opening in August 2019. More at paysbig.com. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit wuwm.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
We'll take a short break and then meet the directors of a new PBS documentary, The Gospel of Eureka. Lake Effect Weekend continues right after this on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. Towering over the Ozark Mountains in Arkansas is a giant statue of Jesus Christ known as Christ of the Ozarks. This seven-story tall white statue gazes over the residents of Eureka Springs and one of its main attractions, the Great Passion Play, a fully produced reenactment of Christ's life and crucifixion in an amphitheater that seats thousands.
What you might not associate with this small Southern Christian town is its LGBTQ population, their political activism, and their embrace of their faith. But that's the story that filmmakers Michael Palmieri and Donald Mosier found when they arrived in Eureka Springs, and their resulting documentary is called The Gospel of Eureka. Palmieri and Mosier joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski by Skype recently to talk about their film and what brought them to the small town of Eureka Springs in the first place.
There was a civil rights ordinance that was happening in the town around 2015. And the company Field of Vision, who was just starting out, they were starting out doing some political online documentaries. And they asked us to go down to Eureka Springs to cover the civil rights ordinance, which involved basically basic civil liberties for LGBTQIA members in the city. And so we went down there and covered that fight over the ordinance and the vote. But once we got down there, we realized there was a much more interesting story there. So we ended up staying down there for about three more years.
That's quite extensive, too. And the ordinance you're talking about is Ordinance 2223. And when you had a little bits of that in your documentary, The Gospel of Eureka, you know, I found a line in there that someone said really intriguing, that everyone is welcome here, even the Christians. So when you guys went into this to cover this aspect and found so much more, did this project kind of shape itself since you went down there on a different premise in itself?
Yeah, in a sense, yes. Eureka is a really unique place, as you can see from the film, but we also found a kind of microcosm for the dialogue that was happening, you know, the more subtle dialogue that was happening within Christian faith on both the left and the right was being played out right in front of us in the town. So the biggest thing was actually there was much to shape out of all that.
Yeah, it's an interesting, you know, juxtaposition how some people and characters in your film have used religion as a way of support for their sexuality, for their life, for the way they live, and others use it classically and all across the world and America to, you know, terrorize or use it as political activism and that kind of thing. So did the townspeople itself, when you were there and getting to know them, did they see their different views of Christianity as something like another battle to be waged amongst themselves?
I don't know if they necessarily thought of it as a battle. I mean, I definitely think the evangelicals in the town possibly see it as a battle, but not all of them. I think that there's a sort of continuity in faith with Southern Christians. So just because you're gay doesn't mean you can't be Christian or hold Christian values or faith. So I think it's more like what we were hoping to do is sort of shape. There is a debate going on in the religious community in general. Members of faith, you know, on both sides, you know, meaning when we say both sides, we mean to say, you know, the more conservative people in the world of faith, and then the people who you'd be considering more liberal, like the LGBTQIA community. But that dialogue is constantly ongoing. And I just don't think many people have really examined it as such. It's always pitched as a battle. It's a little more complicated than that.
Another layer of complexity that's added to this film, especially if you're not from the South, is just the culture of Southern Christianity in itself. So what assumptions about small Southern town Arkansas did you want to dismantle for the audience? Or what did you notice as you were there that you found beautiful and intriguing?
The South tends to be like a metaphorical shorthand for communities that are deep in faith across the United States. Eureka, it kind of shows a dialogue in process. By proximity, the rule of love thy neighbor is not only an idealistic position, it's also a practical one, you know, because you do see everyone every day, and these are small towns. And if you grow up in the South, or if you grow up in American Christianity, you are trained to use the images of the religion as a sort of language unto itself, a kind of, you know, like a poetic language. So what we could see was how one person could take a statement from the Bible or a position of the Bible and interpret it one way, and then a queer person could completely reinvest that passage or that bit of scripture with a self-defining power. And then the two would have to talk to each other, partially because they live in a small town. And the language of Christianity, rather than dividing, actually was a means which two parties who have been taught that they should be enemies have a common language.
With another juxtaposition of using the Bible, Christianity, church in physical settings, you know, you open up this documentary on the Passion Play property grounds. And for myself, speaking as someone who was raised Catholic, I found it a little jarring and it made me a little uncomfortable to be like thrown into that world. So when you first were exploring this town, how did you view it, not just as filmmakers, but personally?
Well, I mean, I guess it's one way to answer the question is when our friends at Field of Vision shared with us that there was this town called Eureka Springs, they showed us this picture and there was this giant statue of Jesus Christ that looks kind of like a milk carton standing on top of the hill. And we thought, OK, that's interesting. So, you know, for us, that's the type of strangeness that we're drawn to initially to begin with. I think it's easy to go into these places, especially like tourist towns, and for lack of a better way of describing it, make fun of people. And we didn't want to do that. It's hard to sort of orient the positions of people who you know, I mean, I do not agree with Randall Christie and some of his positions. I think that the Passion Play is this. It's a cool thing for Christians to go do and see, but I'm not certain that it's espousing, 100% espousing the positions that I, as a gay man, can get behind. But then at the same time, the people who I align with most in the town, the people who are the LGBT Christians in the town, they didn't seem to have an issue with it, and in fact are participating in it. So that opened my eyes towards what is acceptable in this community. What am I not seeing?
When you were going into this town and establishing these relationships, what did the subjects want you to see? Did they have any, you know, reticence at first of being explored on a deeper level for this documentary, or were you welcomed?
Well, that actually kind of gets at the sort of our methodology as filmmakers. I mean, we tend to not work with people who don't wish to, you know, who haven't invited us. The kinds of films that we make only work when you have the participation of people, the full participation of the people who are involved, where there's some sort of pact that occurs before you start filming. That's like, okay, yeah, we're going to do this. We're going to explore something together. I mean, like one of the reasons I think we're able to film at the Passion Play with, say, Randall and Kent and them is that we expressly stated that we didn't want to do something like what you might see in The Daily Show or something, which is sort of going in and shorthanding everything and making fun of people in a way, which I understand serves its purpose, but it doesn't really get us anywhere. We take very seriously the people that we put on screen and we put in front of the camera. And that's how I think we get stuff out of it. So it's definitely like there's a period where you're finding out who it is that you're going to be spending time with, but it doesn't really take much convincing. People either want to talk or they don't.
So how did connecting with your subjects affect you in the long run? You're there for a very long time getting to know people, and it touches you far beyond the final edit is done.
Speaking for myself, you know, I grew up in North Carolina, and I fled because I was physically attacked, and it was an emotionally traumatic place to be a young gay man. And so to find a place like Eureka where people feel free to leave their faith, keep their faith, redefine their faith, whatever their political position is, was kind of a miracle to me. I knew that Southern gay, lesbian, queer Christians were out there just reshaping the faith as they needed it to help themselves. But I was not in a world where I really saw that in action. And so watching that made me reconsider what it was like. It taught me how much things have progressed in 20 years since I was a teenager. And then working at the Passion Play and watching people, we came to realize that there was some sort of campy magic happening at the Passion Play that I wouldn't have expected. When we entered filming the Passion Play, we saw people who were dedicated to putting on a good show, working very hard, feeling like it was part of their faith and their mission, all those things, and we wanted to respect that. But we kind of realized that the audience and the participants were looking for the same thing that when Mike and I or a member of our community goes to a drag show, which is a moment where a community is expressing themselves theatrically for each other. And that was happening in the drag bar, and it was happening on the stage in the Passion Play. And I had to broaden my view of performance and expression, because I wouldn't have, I've never before we did the film would I have thought about the implications of self-expression through performance when you think of conservative Christians.
And for you, Michael?
Everyone in this town definitely surprised me. And I feel like I got very close with a lot of subjects in this film. Lee and Walter specifically, we became really close with. And to me, they were kind of like heroes in a way because of their history working through the AIDS crisis in Memphis and just sort of their outlook in general. But I'd say the same could extend to Kent, who plays Jesus. I mean, I think this is a really dedicated artist and actor and, you know, community activist and just sort of like all around wonderful guy, and who surprised me constantly about, you know, just sort of who he was and what he believed and why. I think everyone in that town has pretty much made their mark on us. Yeah, it's an incredible place, honestly.
Yeah, I think we can both say that to address like change made on us. It's still surprising after all this time that we made a film sort of, you know, looking at and sometimes praising Christianity at all. This is not something either one of us expected that we would end up doing.
And, right. Yeah, in a way, it's like saying praising Christianity. It's sort of like they're examining or, you know, there's this book. It's called the Bible. It has these things in it. You know, there's a lot of ways of interpreting the Bible. And I think in large part, the people of Eureka Springs are interpreting the things in the Bible that we all kind of agree are good things. And the things that they're sort of wrestling over are the things I think the larger culture has always been wrestling over. Yeah, I'm not sure if I'm forwarding the the conversation much.
No, it's good. That kind of leads me to one thing I was feeling watching it, you know, because a lot of people experience, similar to you, Donal, like you flee something that you were raised on because you realize it doesn't line up with your beliefs, your principles, who you are. And many times, perhaps actively try not to think about it, to not engage. And then here's your documentary that shows communities fully engaging in their faith, no matter what their identity is. And do you feel like, you know, this could not challenge in a bad way, but could make people reevaluate their perspectives on how people can live both with their identity and their faith?
Well, we hope that's the case. I mean, that's absolutely the issue. I mean, just because I'm not a Christian doesn't mean that what Christians are doing in this film makes any of their beliefs wrong or off base.
I feel like for some people, you leave the church, but the church doesn't leave you. You know, for other people, you just flat on move on and can't look back. And the dialogue about, you know, conservative Christians and, you know, people on the left and the dialogue, you know, for conservative Christians about people on the left, there's so much divisiveness that if this film can just make people pause and kind of understand, like, for myself, I am not really a proponent of organized religion at all. I don't think it's done humanity much good if you look at the long stretch of history, you know, but it's not going anywhere. And we're not going to erase Christianity from the fabric of American life. So we should see the breadth of it as much as we can and find what strengths it can give to making progressive choices.
As these dynamics kind of remain cyclical and ever-present, how do you want people to go away from your documentary?
Well, certainly, I mean, on the simplest level, there's more similarities than differences here. Both the drag shows and the passion play, really, they're both drag shows. So in some ways, we're sort of leveling the playing field that way by showing how similar the performances are. And then there's similarities in the way people believe, the core of what people are believing in. I mean, love thy neighbor is something that people of all different backgrounds can find common ground with. But the ways in which they express that is different, you know, in different parts of the community. But in fact, you know, when we put it through our lens, it's actually quite similar and hopefully to comic and enjoyable effect.
Yeah. I mean, one of our mottos when making the film, we were following Dolly Parton's show advice, which was make them laugh, make them cry, terrorize them, send them home. And so if we did any of those three, then when we're happy.
Well, I think you certainly accomplished Dolly's advice here. Michael and Janelle, thank you both so much for taking some time to talk about The Gospel of Eureka.
Thanks for having us.
Film and multimedia artists Michael Palmieri and Donald Mosier directed The Gospel of Eureka. The documentary premiered on PBS's series POV this month and is now available to watch online at pbs.org. And that wraps up the show today. I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Stay tuned now for All Things Considered. Coming up next, it's 4 o'clock.